this morning. We have students that we want to especially welcome. We have Milwaukee Bayview students. Would they stand, please? Good seeing you all. You may be seated. We're expecting externs from the Department of Justice, but they have not yet arrived. We want to explain that the Milwaukee Bayview students are here with the Courtwood Class program that is operated by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. This is a national award-winning program, and what we do is send the briefs of the case that the students will hear after they accept our invitation to come. And at noon or thereabouts, after the second case that we hear, a justice will visit with them and discuss the procedures of the court in taking cases, hearing cases, and deciding cases, but there will be no discussion of the substantive issues of the case. Anyone who wishes may join the students and the justice at noon. With that explanation, I want to introduce the court to you all. Starting on my left is Justice Michael Gableman. Seated next to him is Justice Patience Rogensack. You will meet with Justice Rogensack after the second presentation and oral argument. Seated to my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and to her right is Justice David Prosser, and on the far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductions made, I will now call our first case, 07AP934, Friedrich Memorial Lutheran Hospital versus National States Insurance Company, and representing the petitioner is Norman D. Farnham. Counsel?
Justice, thank you, Justices. We appreciate the opportunity to appear this morning. My name is Norm Farnham. I am a member of the law firm of Stroud, Long & Howard here in Madison. I have with me today my co-counsel, John Lobmeyer, and we are here to represent the interest of National States Insurance Company. The issue before this court affects a huge population in the state of Wisconsin. According to OCI, 806,000 Wisconsin residents are currently eligible for Medicare benefits. Of that population, as of 2003, 308,875 had Medigap policies. So the decision of the Court of Appeals will affect a significant population in the state of Wisconsin. Mrs. Ledger was one of the people who was covered by Medicare and who had a Medigap policy. Contrary to Friedrich's position in this case, the case does not begin in October 2000, when Ms. Ledger was admitted to Friedrich for the third time for continuing renal failure. In fact, the case begins in May 2000, when she was initially admitted to Friedrich. She spent the rest of her life hospitalized after that initial admission. She was continuously hospitalized. After her initial admission, Medicare paid the cost of her hospitalization at the Medicare reimbursement rate.
So let me just interrupt for a minute, because I want to clarify what you just said. You said she was continually hospitalized, but not at Friedrich.
That is correct.
She was there a transfer?
She was transferred back and forth between Friedrich and another hospital, Vancouver Hospital, on two separate occasions. So she was at Friedrich, transferred for a time to Vancouver, which is a long-term care facility, transferred back to Friedrich, transferred again to Vancouver. Then eventually in October 2000, transferred back to Friedrich for the last time, where she remained for the rest of her life until February 2001.
So is the long-term facility a hospital?
Yes, it is, I believe.
Okay. And so she came from there to Friedrich in September?
That's correct.
Thank you.
And that's the crux of it. When she was readmitted to Frater, she'd exhausted her Medicare coverage days. So in October, she had none of those days left, but she did have the Medigap policy. When she was readmitted then, Frater began to charge not at the Medicare reimbursement rate that it was entitled to charge at before, which is a greatly reduced rate. It began to charge the standard charges, which are substantially higher than the reimbursement rate. In this case, it amounts to $130,000 worth of additional charges. Now, Frater has taken the position that this case turns on the fact that when Ms. Ledger was readmitted to Frater in October 2000, she had no Medicare days left. It has conceded in its reply brief to the Court of Appeals that had she had any Medicare days left, Frater would have been able only to charge at the reimbursement rate. However, because she had no days left, Frater takes position it can charge at whatever rate it wants to charge. Now, this creates a terrible system because it means that your coverage as a Medicare recipient turns on who owns the bed you're laying in the day that your coverage lapses.
Isn't your policy designed only to cover when Medicare doesn't?
I'm sorry?
Isn't your policy designed to cover when Medicare doesn't? Isn't that what the policy is?
Well, the policy covers a number of things. It covers deductibles, it covers co-payments, and then...
But in this case...
Right, at the end of the Medicare reimbursement days, the policy steps in and covers what Medicare would have paid for. And that's what our policy says, and that's what the Wisconsin regulations...
Where does it say that? Where does it say you pay what Medicare would have paid for?
Well,
isn't that the issue in the case?
That is the issue.
Yeah, so you can't say that's what the policy says, because that's the issue, is whether that's what the policy
says. Well, let me explain how the policy, we get there under the policy language. And I think Judge Fine in the dissent had the correct approach, and understanding how he got there will help us understand what the policy language says. Now, what the policy says in this instance is, if maximum benefits have been paid under Medicare for inpatient hospital expenses, including lifetime reserve days, we will pay all further expenses incurred for hospital confinement that would have been covered by Medicare. Now, what the dissent has said is, first we look at when this provision is triggered. It's triggered when inpatient hospital coverage under Medicare is exhausted. They said, second, what happens? National States has promised that all further expenses incurred under hospital confinement will be paid, provided those further expenses would have been covered by Medicare Part A. So the sentence says there's no dispute here that Medicare Part A would not have covered the charges that Frater is imposing, the standard charges that would have only covered at the Medicare reimbursement rate. Now, I think what the dissent is driving at is, and the crux of this language, is the word covered and understanding what that word means. There are dictionary definitions that help us understand what the word covered means. For instance, if we look at Merriam-Webster's online dictionary, it says cover means to defray the cost of. In other words, as it says in the dictionary, cover expenses.
Counsel doesn't tell us what the expenses are. What does Medicare eligible expense above mean?
What does it mean?
That means health care expense, which is covered by Medicare, recognized as medically necessary and reasonable by Medicare, and which may or may not be fully reimbursed by Medicare. That's the exact words of the regulation, isn't it?
That is the exact words of the regulation. What you do to understand what the regulation in 2001, and by the way, today.
And how does that fit with sub 4 or part B4 that you just read?
Well, the way this works is that the Medicare eligible expenses must meet three criteria. It has to be covered by Medicare. It has to be recognized as medically necessary and reasonable by Medicare. And there are expenses that may or may not have been fully reimbursed by Medicare. Okay? The Court of Appeals has fixed on the which may or may not have been fully reimbursed by Medicare.
That's why I'm fixing on it.
And they've said that, well, gee, doesn't that mean it can be expenses beyond the Medicare? first. The problem with that reading is that it leaves no meaning for the recognized as medically necessary and reasonable by Medicare. Those are the expenses, and that's what the regulation says. It's health care expenses, which are covered.
Does that mean that when I'm not on Medicare and I go in and they charge me more, that that's not medically reasonable? That's not, what is it, like, necessary and reasonable?
You're a Medicare-eligible individual?
No.
If you're not in the Medicare system at all, then the hospital is not constrained by the bargain it made with the Medicare system.
Yeah, but I don't have to pay anything that's unnecessary or unreasonable.
Well, the Freda's position does appear to be that that it's not constrained by the necessariness or reasonableness of the charges. But what this says is that the expenses have to be necessary and reasonable, and necessary and reasonable, recognized by as medically necessary and reasonable by Medicare. And it's the recognition by Medicare of what is necessary and reasonable that tells us it's the Medicare reimbursement rate.
Counselor, as I look at the phrase you're trying to interpret, I look at it in the context of the whole policy. And one section in the policy for inpatient psychiatric hospital benefits says, if you incur expense for hospital confinement as a result of psychiatric disorder, we will pay your hospital expenses at Medicare's reimbursement rate for up to a maximum of 175 days. This benefit will apply only after you have exhausted Medicare coverage. Now, it's phrased there that the rate you're going to pay at is Medicare's rate. But in the section that you and the Chief Justice have been talking about, it just talks about expense. It doesn't say anything about Medicare reimbursement rate. I'd like you to address that second paragraph and tell me why I shouldn't use it in determining whether or not the first paragraph is clear and unambiguous.
Sure. Well, the paragraph dealing with post-Medicare exhaustion reimbursement rates does say expenses, and it's qualified that are covered by Medicare. So it does, using different language, more efficient language, really get at the same concept.
Well, it doesn't say Medicare's reimbursement rate in the paragraph that you initially began to look at. And it's that term that troubles me, because in one section of the policy, you have chosen to clearly say you're going to pay at Medicare's reimbursement rate. In the other section of the policy, all you're saying is that you're going to pay further expense incurred for hospital confinement that would have been covered by Medicare. So it doesn't really say whether or not you're going to use Medicare's rate or some other rate, and that's what's kind of bothering me.
Okay. As I say, our position is that covered means paid, and if you understand it that way, it's all. But there are other provisions of this policy.
Uh-huh.
That if you were to look to those using kind of this imperi materia methodology, you could see that if we wanted to, for instance, pay at the standard rate, the policy defines usual and customary. If you look at the policy in the appendix page 150, the policy says it defines usual and customary as meaning the usual fees charged by a Medicare provider for a given service to a private patient, i.e., the provider's own usual fees. I think that's the same as Frager's standard fees. Now, having defined what usual and customary expenses are, if Frater, if national states intended to pay at the rates that Frater seeks to impose, we could have been crystal clear in this Part B, Section 4, by saying we're covering the usual, the customary and usual expenses.
Well, but it says usual and customary provision only applies to chiropractic services and diabetic equipment and supplies.
Right. So the insurer who's reading this policy to understand that those are the usual and customary, that's the measure of the usual.
Does it apply in this case, usual and customary? Does it apply in this case?
It applies to the extent that we're looking at other parts of this policy to help us interpret what Part B be for, but no, absolutely not. We're not saying that the usual summons.
This is not chiropractic.
Is that?
Because it's not chiropractic.
Absolutely, that's
okay.
Right.
Now, there's another provision. Look at exceptions and limitations, Part J, which says nursing home care covered by Medicare. Then it says home health care not covered by Medicare beyond. And then the third one says doctor's charges above Medicare approved amounts.
Yes.
So you've got
We have to deal with that
different words.
Charge. I'm sorry, we have to deal with that charge separately in the policy because it works differently under Medicare. Doctor charges above Medicare approved amounts come up under Medicare Part B. Now, doctors are not constrained in the same way that hospitals are. They will see a patient, and they can bill on what's called an assigned or an unassigned basis. An assigned basis means that they are going to pay what Medicare will pay. An unassigned basis means they won't. So they're permitted to charge above Medicare's rate explicitly in the Social Security statute. So we have to deal with that in a different way than you deal with a balanced billing that's prohibited by specifically saying that under this policy, doctors are not going to be able to charge anything but at the assigned rate. So that deals with a specific issue that's raised by the statutes. And it's just a different issue than is raised by hospitalization, which is which has to be billed at the Medicare reimbursement rate.
Counsel, I see this simply. Now, maybe I'm wrong, and so you can tell me. But I see this, anytime you have a case involving an insurance policy, the very first thing you do, of course, is you go to the policy and you read the policy. That's what controls. This is the contract. And I look at the language in sub 4, and I've listened to all these questions and answers. Now, you look at sub 4. I see this, and I'm talking about sub 4 benefits to supplement Medicare Part A, as a matter of grammar. So I want the students to listen. Got it? It's a matter of grammar. Do you know how to diagram sentences?
Sure, yes.
Okay. Let's take the clause that's in issue is that would have been covered by Medicare Part A. Right? Am I wrong or am I right? Maybe I'm wrong. I mean, listen, let me tell you the way I see it, and then you correct me. That might be the easiest. I see the clause that's in issue is that would have been covered by Medicare Part A. Okay. I see the contest here is what does that modify? What does it modify, that clause? Does that clause modify expenses that would have been covered by Medicare Part A, or does that modify hospital confinement that would have been covered by Medicare Part A? I see your argument as that it modifies expenses. I see your opponent's argument that it modifies, if you were diagramming, you would attach it to hospital confinement. What kind of hospital confinement? Hospital confinement that would have been covered by Medicare Part A. But, aha, I see your argument as a misplaced modifier. In other words, the clause attends to hospital confinement and not earlier on in the sentence the word expense. So I'd say you lose on that argument because your argument isn't as I understand grammar. I might be wrong on the grammar. Grammatically correct. And I'm just looking because that's what we have to do. Interpret the words of the policy as it's written. Now respond to me why I'm wrong. Respond to me why that would have been covered by Medicare Part A modifies expenses.
Because that when this court, first of all, our position is that the language is not ambiguous. you don't find ambiguity just because a subject or that sentence has two subjects or could plausibly be ambiguous. You look at it in the context.
Well, if you were diagramming that clause that would have been covered by Medicare Part A, what would you be attaching it to?
Well, I think you'd have to attach it to expenses because covered means paid, and it makes sense to say pay expenses. It doesn't make sense to say pay hospital.
But you've got, what does it modify? What kind of expenses? Expenses, the clauses that would have been covered by Medicare Part A. But isn't the rule that the modifier should go closer to what it modifies? You have the modifier, I thought, misplaced. Am I wrong or right?
Well, I think that the expenses are those incurred by for hospital confinement. So that's all part of one clause.
But then
so the modifier,
why wouldn't you put it, we will pay all further expenses that would have been covered by Medicare Part A for hospital confinement. Mm-hmm, for hospital confinement, or incurred for hospital. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You could do that as well. Why it wasn't done like that, I'm not sure, but again, the issue is that it's what we're covering here is expenses. So we have to understand what sort of expenses are being covered, and they're the expenses that would have been covered by Medicare Part A, understood as would have been paid by Medicare Part A. I don't, you have to read the all further expenses incurred for hospital confinement as a unit, and it's that would have been covered by Medicare as modifying that unit.
Isn't that the difference between the majority opinion and the dissent in the Court of Appeals? Mm-hmm. How they interpret the clause that would have been covered by Medicare Part A.
That's right.
Majority says, hey, you could read it either way, but the insurance company drafted the policy. A reasonable interpretation would read it that it is hospital confinement that's occurred, and therefore that's the way we're going to read it.
Well, the dissent decided it was not ambiguous in part, I believe, because it was reading it in context and understanding that what we have is a regulation here that dictates and controls what Medicare policies have to cover in 2001 and then as clarified in 2005. And so the dissent doesn't find ambiguity there because it's reading it in context. We can find ambiguity here in any sentence if we're not reading it in context.
Does this have anything to do with doctor bills?
What's that?
Does this have anything to do with payments for physicians?
No, those are covered under Medicare Part B. So that if you are paying, if you're having a doctor bill submitted under the section of the policy that discusses what the doctor bills have to be, you'll see that they need to be.
And this doesn't cover.
But this doesn't address if you go.
Any kind of outpatient?
Or a checkup. Well, it covers skilled nursing care as well. Not this provision, but post-Medicare exhaustion coverage cover skilled nursing care. But each of those are separate sorts of coverages governed by separate sorts of rules.
You're saying the lady involved here was in hospital confinement the entire time from May through when she started in October?
That's correct.
There was no outpatient treatment at any.
It was a long-term care facility. It was she was hospitalized. That's right. So that, again, what the issue from the perspective of Medicare days is that because she ran out of coverage days while at Vancouver before coming back to Frater, that's what triggers Frater's right, according to Frater, to charge the standard charges. So that means that really all a hospital has to do to substantially increase what it can charge is make sure that the insured is not in the hospital on the day that the charges or that the coverage lapses. So it creates a system that encourages hospitals to, you know, escape the confines of the Medicare negotiated rates by moving patients around. That's the system it creates. The Court of Appeals decision creates an even worse system, even under today's regulation, because because there's no dispute that under the 2005 regulation, which clarifies the 2001 regulation, Medicare policies cover at the reimbursement rate. It's crystal clear. There's no question about that. What the Court of Appeals is saying is, well, once you've lost Medicare reimbursement days as a patient, the hospital can charge whatever it wants. So in Wisconsin today, the Medicare policy covers up the reimbursement rate. If the Court of Appeals is correct, there's a big gap there between the reimbursement rate and the hospital standard charges that are not covered by Medigap policies.
So do you want to tell us, because your time is running down, a little bit about why you're opposed to the 12% interest?
Absolutely. We believe that the 12% interest was imposed by the trial court without really any thought to it. There was no finding whatsoever regarding the 12% interest. It was not asked for in the initial briefings by Frater. It was not asked for in the summary judgment pleadings by Frater. It was not asked for when Frater initially taxed his costs. It was an afterthought, and the court, without making any findings, imposed it. What we have here is a situation where we have a well-reasoned dissent who tells us he agrees with us. So I think that the issue is, at the very least, fairly debatable. You would think that the opposite conclusion is that the dissent is simply unreasonable, and I don't think anybody's going to take that position.
Do you think that the circuit court judge had to make a particular finding here in order to impose the 12%?
Well, the 12% is only appropriate if we did not have a reasonable basis for pursuing this claim. There's nothing to review if that trial court makes no findings as to why we don't have a reasonable basis. So it would essentially be an unreviewable determination, but they have to tell us why they think that that we were completely unreasonable.
Counselor, there are some cases, I know what you're talking about, and many of the initial cases talk about this as a factual question. There are some later cases that talk about it as a combination of fact and law, and the law would be we interpret insurance policies as a matter of law.
Right.
So you kind of get both of them stuck together, and I didn't think that there were any factual disputes about A, where she was, and B, that Medicare Part A wasn't paying anymore. What kind of finding could the trial court make?
Well, it would have to be a finding. It would have to be a finding in that the position we took was unreasonable. It would be as a matter of law.
Well, you make, I'm not maybe saying it clearly. In my parlance as an appellate judge, findings of fact are findings. Questions of law are conclusions, okay? So there are some cases that talk about it as a factual predicate. You have to have certain facts. Then there are later cases that say, well, yes, but it is really a combination of fact and law, the law being the application of the policy. And so here my question to you is, I didn't think there were any disputes about any findings of fact between you and opposing counsel, that if there were disputes, it was how the law applied to the facts at issue. Am I accurate in that?
I believe that's correct.
Okay, so if I'm accurate in that, there really isn't anything for the trial court to have made a finding of fact on, is there?
No, it'd be a conclusion of law that our position was unreasonable under the policy.
Okay, good. That's just so I'm clear on what we're talking about.
Also, I need to ask you a follow-up question on the ambiguity issue. In response to several of the questions from my colleagues, you've mentioned that the relevant provision is not ambiguous, in part because of the reasoning expressed by Judge Fine in his dissent in relation to the regulations. Is there any way that a policyholder, someone who had this policy, someone who was in the position of the decedent, would know that your client interpreted the relevant provision to incorporate by reference those regulations?
That the policyholder would know that? I don't know that the policyholder would know that. I think that the policyholder would be looking at the phrase covered and deciding that it means paid. But we don't have a choice, as to what language we use. We have to have this language approved by OCI.
Well, that raises a question that would be a follow-up to Justice Rogensack's first question in regard to the provision concerning the psychiatric hospitalization stays. It seems that the language there was pretty unambiguous and pretty clear.
just as clear as this section.
So then my follow-up to your most recent answer would be, why couldn't such unambiguous and clear language have been used in regard to this provision?
It could have been. I think the language that was used was more economical. I don't know that we have, that there's any obligation that just because the policy says something one way, one place, it has to say it the same exact way in another place.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. My time is up. I ask leave to just summarize our position.
You will have a few minutes at rebuttal. Thank you, Counselor.
Thank you.
Susan, Attorney Susan E. Lovern, representing the hospital.
May it please the court, I am Susan Lovern, and I do represent Frederick Memorial Lutheran Hospital in this matter. I wanted to start just quickly with the issue raised by counsel about the continuous hospitalization and it being Frederick's position that if at least one day was covered, we would have been confined by the Medicare reimbursement rate, and so there's an incentive to transfer patients. I simply want to clarify that it's not Frederick's position, it's the Medicare law regarding this issue. Medicare provides that where a hospitalization stay includes at least one covered day, then Medicare governs what the reimbursement rate will be. And so in this case, when she was admitted into Frederick, she had no covered days left. Medicare had nothing to say about what the charges would be, and thus it was not covered by Medicare. That's the point that we were trying to make with that illustration. And that's referenced to 42 CFR section 412.42 sub B and is also explained in our brief. The issue of, well, wasn't there a covered date because she had been previously hospitalized at another hospital, so isn't that a continuous hospitalization, is not supported by these regulations. It's further not supported by the facts, because the facts are that with regard to the last admission at Frederick, we did not receive payment for any Medicare Part A because that hospital stay was considered by Medicare not to include a covered day. So this is not something that is Frederick's position or is being created by the Court of Appeals, but is simply part of the Medicare law in this case, and I wanted to clarify that if there were any questions. Then I would like to turn to the policy at issue that is the focus in this case. What did national states agree to ensure? And I think that if we look at the relevant language, we have many reasons to agree with the Court of Appeals and with the trial court and with the OCI that this language means that would have been covered by Medicare Part A modifies hospital confinement. As the OCI said, this clause doesn't mention how the claim will be paid. It talks about hospital confinements that would have been covered. The Circuit Court also agreed that this language, in the context of the policy, is not ambiguous. It talks about the nature of the services provided as would be covered by Medicare, not the amount or the rate that would have been billed. The Court of Appeals also agreed, especially with reference to the provision that the justices discussed earlier with my opposing counsel, that when you especially read down the policy 1, 2, 3, 4, benefits to supplement Medicare Part A, you first see the inpatient psychiatric hospital benefit, which clearly sets forth that they will pay your hospital expenses at the Medicare's reimbursement rate. Within the context of the policy, I think it's clear that we don't have ambiguous language here that would have been covered by Medicare Part A refers to hospital confinement. And the word covered is not the word paid. If they had intended to use the word paid by Medicare Part A, that would have solved our problems here. Just as having used the language, we will pay at Medicare's reimbursement rate.
But counsel, doesn't that beg the question about the ambiguity that obviously Medicare, not all of these expenses would have been covered by Medicare. There's $130,725 over and above what Medicare would have been entitled or would have been required to pay. Why is that not ambiguous?
It's not ambiguous within the context, because within the context we see that they could have limited themselves to the Medicare's reimbursement rate and they didn't do so in this provision. When we look at what is, when it says all further expenses incurred for hospital confinement that would have been covered, this doesn't talk about how the claim is going to be paid. It talks about what types of claims are going to be paid. Hospital confinement that's covered by Medicare Part A. To just discuss briefly the dissent's opinion and why I do believe respectfully that it is unreasonable in this case, the dissent's interpretation of the policy and its parallel interpretation of the statute simply doesn't work in this case for several reasons. First of all, it interprets the provision in isolation and ignores the language two paragraphs above that limit payment to the Medicare reimbursement rate. But more importantly, and I think, Justice Gableman, you pointed this out previously, if we're interpreting this from the context of a reasonable insured, and a reasonable insured is looking at the language and they are to accept the dissent's and National States' interpretation that their hospital confinement, or that all further expenses are going to be paid, not just covered, but paid, how do they know what that means? From the insured's perspective, if their expenses are paid by Medicare Part A, what that means to them is they have a deductible and nothing else. What it
means to National, I agree with you that you certainly do interpret insurance policies from the reasonable position of the insured, but I don't think we interpret statutes that way. And the right to 12% is a statutory right. So are you arguing that the reasonable position of the insured ought to govern our interpretation of a statute?
I'm talking about the policy language and how a reasonable insured would have interpreted the policy.
That's fine, but I thought you were talking about 12% interest. Maybe I just misunderstood what you were saying.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I wasn't talking about
it. That's my mistake. Sorry.
We're incorporating by reference the question I had asked your opposing counsel concerning how would a policyholder be aware that opposing counsel's client interpreted that provision in such a fashion to limit the payment amount.
Correct. I'm sorry if that wasn't clear. From the insured's perspective, if it was covered at the as covered by Medicare, that may mean, well, then I'm just liable for the deductible or the co-payments. Yet National States in the dissent would say covered by Medicare Part A means that the Medicare reimbursement rates, and I think that's consistent with the question you were asking earlier.
And so obviously you agree with your opposing counsel that there is nothing in the policy language that would put a policyholder on notice of such an interpretation.
I do agree.
Is this, in your view, a case of sloppy drafting by the insurance company? In other words, could they simply put the language about Medicare's reimbursement rate in B4? If you win the case, can they just run back to the office and change the language in B4?
Well, I think that outcome is now governed by the change to the insurance guidelines found in the Wisconsin Administrative Code. And the Wisconsin Administrative Code, effective July 1, 2005, now provide that the required coverage under a Medicare policy such as this one need only, if I can read from the statute, to the extent the hospital is permitted to charge by federal law and regulation and subject to the Medicare reimbursement rate. So policies that have been drafted since July 1, 2005 forward contain different language and are not subject to this ambiguity, which is one reason why I would further respectfully disagree that this case or the outcome of what the Court of Appeals did in this case, under the facts of this case, under the policy of this case, under the law as it existed at the time, will not have broad sweeping ramifications to consumers in this context.
If there had been no Medigap policy here, would you have charged the deceased at the rate, the rate that you're charging the insurance company?
Yes, once Medicare expires, providers in the state are allowed to bill their full customary charges. They always have the same amounts that they charge. What's limited is what they have to accept as full payment. Under Medicare, once the Medicare reimbursement rate is given to the hospital has agreed via contracts with the governing agency to accept that as full payment. Once Medicare expires, the hospital is no longer required to accept reduced rates unless the patient has some sort of other coverage or from an insurance company or a benefit plan that also has a voluntarily negotiated contract rate, as many HMOs or CMOs or insurance companies do have. So, yes.
Counselor, I have a question about that. It was one thing I found very interesting in this case, in that HICFA, and it's got a different name now, but it does have the ability to set what providers can charge as payment in full. I think it's now called the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. And HICFA incorporated and adopted the NAIC regs in 1998. And at first I thought, when I was looking at this, well, you couldn't charge any more than NAIC said. But the reg that changed, the NAIC reg that changed what must be accepted as payment in full, came in between two adoptions. And I guess my concern is, now that HICFA has adopted the NAIC reg saying you have to accept this payment in full, the Medicare rate, is there really a window still open for you to charge pretty much any rate for future payments? And they didn't adopt it until 2004, so it's not going to apply here. At first I thought that it did because NAIC adopted it in 98, but HICFA didn't adopt that part of it until 2004. But I'm wondering, going forward, does this case have limited applicability or broad applicability, if you know, in regard to now what HICFA has done with their adoption on things that apply to a provider, not to an insurance company?
Correct. HICFA did ask the NAIC to promulgate model rules. Those model rules, or regulations, if you will, were adopted. But Wisconsin was a waiver state from the very beginning. Wisconsin had standardized its own plans. They weren't required to adopt the NAIC regulations. Moving forward, they have now made changes to the Wisconsin State Administrative Code to conform where required to do so to the NAIC model regulations. I think the critical point here is that the NAIC model regulation relied upon by the other side, section 8.3B, the language therein specifically says that the provider cannot pursue the patient for what Medigap doesn't charge. However, Wisconsin was not required to adopt that law, and they did not adopt that law.
Well, to me, and it doesn't have to be to you, I think the NAIC and OCI regulate insurance policies. I don't think they have the authority, or at least that was one of the arguments that was made. They don't have the authority to regulate providers, but HICFA does. And if HICFA adopts a part of it that does apply to providers, my concern was something about opposing counsel raised, well, if you're right, then you can just charge whatever you want to anybody that doesn't have a Medigap policy. But if, in fact, HICFA adopted this part that applies to providers, is it Frater's position that they can still go ahead and charge it because this was an insurance reg, or is it Frater's position they're now going to be governed through HICFA on this?
My understanding is that the HICFA regular, or the model regulations that were required to be adapted by Wisconsin have been adapted to the extent they were required to be adapted, which did not include the language that a provider has to accept that amount as full payment. And so in Wisconsin...
Yeah, well, we're talking about something different. I'm not talking about OCI at all. So, I'm sorry, we're probably
I understand your question. If I'm
not... It revolves around HICFA, not around OCI
but
at all.
HICFA incorporated... I'm sorry if I said OCI. HICFA incorporated the NAIC regs.
Yes, yes.
The OCI, because it's in charge of our insurance regs here, made the corresponding changes that HICFA required to be made under the law. Does that answer your question?
That can only govern insurance policies. OCI doesn't have any authority over providers.
Right, but OCI has incorporated into 3.39 of the Administrative Code the NAIC model regulations that HICFA required them to incorporate.
I understand. Okay, all right. Thank you.
And I think what's important there is that Wisconsin, following HICFA law and incorporating under the OCI order, the change to the regulation required by HICFA through the NAIC model regulations did not adopt the language that would limit the provider to accepting Medicare reimbursement rates as payment in full. In fact, there's been discussion about whether NAIC had the authority to put that in their model regulations, and I understand your question to be, now that HCFS has incorporated them.
See, I think if there's any enforcement ability, it's going to come through HCFS. It can't come through NAIC or Wisconsin as a waiver statement through OCI, because they don't really govern what the provider does. They govern what an insurance company has to do.
Correct. And within the scope of federal Medicare law, it is now prohibited for us to charge these rates once Medicare has expired. Under the NAIC model regulations, it would be. Wisconsin, through HCFS, was required to make some of those changes, was not required to make that particular change, and has not chosen to do so at this time.
Council, I've got a question about OCI, since we seem to be on that subject. It's my understanding, as this dispute was going on, that the Office of the Commissioner of Insurance expressed at least a couple of times, I believe, an opinion as to how to interpret this policy. Are we to give that any deference? And if so, why?
Because the OCI is charged with administering Section 3.39 of the Wisconsin Administrative Code, which governs these Medigap policies, and under which the Medigap policy at issue in this case was issued, if you will, I do think that those letters are entitled to some deference. However, because they're interpreting a policy and not the regulation itself, I don't think they would be necessarily be entitled to great weight deference. But the OCI was clear in saying two things. One, that they believed the policy language required payment, and they would have known the context of the underlying law and did not find a discrepancy there. In addition, they pointed out that while NAIC model regulations may have resulted in a different outcome, Wisconsin has not adopted those regulations as a waiver state, and thus NAIC's proposed conclusion was not accurate.
Are you entitled to 12% interest?
Yes, with regard to the 12% interest, to follow up on what Justice Rogensack was saying, I would agree that there was no factual dispute in the trial court with regard to coverage, no factual finding for the trial court to make. Instead, letter briefs were submitted to the court on why the legal issues were or were not or should not be considered fairly debatable. The trial court, by then deciding, by issuing its order, awarding the 12%, made a determination that the legal coverage issues were not fairly debatable in the trial court's estimation. And in that regard, there's a comment made that, you know, evidence of a dissenting opinion should show that legal issues are fairly debatable, such that we would not be entitled to 12% interest. I disagree that the dissent's opinion is necessarily a reasonable approach in this case for some of the reasons discussed in the brief and here today. While it may be evidence that the issues are debatable, the question is whether they're fairly debatable at the expense of the provider, such that the provider has lost the time value of money in this case. And so the 12% interest is meant to compensate for the time value of money. And while the issues may be debatable, we're debating them today. Both the trial court and court of appeals, I think, set forth very well-reasoned explanations for why national states, when looking at this issue at the time, should not have considered this to be fairly debatable given the law of the state, the OCI interpretations, the facts of the language of their policy, and the overreaching Medicare and state law, which do not in any way prohibit or support what national states wanted this policy to mean at this time. So it would be our position that yes, we are entitled to the 12% interest.
Under that statute, is there any requirement that the third-party claimant, or maybe it isn't a third-party, who is making the claim against the insurance company?
Rater, it is via an assignment, and so it's our position that it would be a first-party claim.
But not a third-party claim. Right. Is there any requirement, a demand has to be made under the statute, any reference to the statute?
No, I do not believe that there is. There is. We're Wisconsin case law that provides that no specific demand has to be made, that 62846 is by on its face part of every insurance contract in the state. We asked for in our complaint interest according to law. So just as, for example, you may be entitled to 5% interest for prejudgment if it's liquidated damages, or 12% if an offer of settlement is made in the case, or a different percent for penalty reasons under the statute that doesn't have to be specifically demanded in the complaint to receive the 12% interest. The case is cited in the brief as far as it being incorporated into the insurance contract. I'm sorry, I don't have it at my fingertips. And if you mean, I hope I understood your question correctly. Does that answer your question?
What I'm really trying to get at is you're not claiming bad faith on the part of the insurance company, are you?
It's not a bad faith case. We're simply seeking the 12% interest. Our position is that there was no question that there was coverage in this case. There's no factual dispute that there was coverage. The only issues raised were legal issues regarding the contract interpretation, which the trial court and court of appeals.
And the insurance company, was it $73,000 or something like that that they paid?
Correct. That sounds correct. Yes.
They didn't dispute paying that, or they didn't drag their feet paying that, did they?
Correct.
But in a sense, you're saying that the law was so clear that they have to pay every penny of this, that they're going to get socked with 12% interest. Is that right?
That would be one way to interpret our argument. I think the way that I would put our argument is that the law was very clear. There was no federal or state law to support National State's position in this case. While they are trying to create new policy, if you will, at this stage, whether coverage was fairly debatable under the law at the time was not fairly debatable. It may have been debatable, if you will, but the 12%, these charges were provided by Freightert in 2001. So the time value of money here is what's at issue. It's not meant to penalize them for litigating if they want to take that risk, but they could have paid the full amount of the charges and litigated the claim, and they chose not to, and Freightert has been deprived of its money for an issue that both the trial court and the Court of Appeals found was not fairly debatable.
Well, let's look at the Court of Appeals opinion, because we have Judge Fine. Because we have Judge Fine writing a dissent. And as I read his brief dissent with regard to the policy, it wasn't regarding any legal argument so much that it cited a case or a particular code provision or statutory provision. He looked at the words of the policy and he interpreted it differently than the majority. And came to the same interpretation as your opposing counsel does. So, it appears to me that it's a reasoned decision. Might be right, might be wrong. Lots of times, there are a lot of reasoned decisions that I would agree with, and a few I might disagree with, but it seems like a reasoned and reasonable decision. Why isn't it? I mean, you're essentially saying what Judge Fine is writing there is unreasonable. There is no reasonable debate as to the language of the policy that he engages in.
Yes, I do believe that that's true. It's not a reasonable interpretation of the policy. I don't think that his interpretation works either under the policy as being reasonable or either in the statute. If we look at the policy first, as we've discussed previously, to say that that language is unambiguous, first of all, the OCI, the Circuit Court, the Court of Appeals, courts in other states have found the same language to mean something very different. So to state that it's unambiguous language does not appear to be, to me, a persuasive explanation.
Well, you're saying the language is unambiguous, aren't you?
Only in the context of the policy as a whole. Only in the context of the policy.
So the language in and of itself, that phrase in and of itself, you think is, or rather that, when I say phrase, I mean that part of the policy, part four, that we're looking at, do you think that is clear?
I do believe that that is clear. I would agree with your approach on how we look at the sentence and what that would have been covered by Medicare Part A modifies, modifying hospital confinement.
You find no ambiguity in sub four?
Within the context of the policy or standing alone?
Standing alone.
Standing alone, from the perspective of an insured, I do not. I would not say that there would be ambiguity there. Because an insured will see all further expense incurred for things covered by Medicare, and as we had discussed previously, they would have no idea what that would mean other than it is all covered. To parse out whether that means, does that mean I would owe a deductible, or does that mean that they would pay the Medicare reimbursement rate? I would say that would be unambiguous from a point of a reasonable insured. And, you know, not only does the dissent's interpretation ignore the language two paragraphs above regarding Medicare reimbursement rate, it also then tries to draw a parallel construction, saying this is further supported by my construction of the statute. And very briefly, I'd like to show how the interpretation and the dissent of the statute also fails. If we look,
before you do that, I'd like to follow through with what Justice Bradley was asking you. 2 years ago, this court decided the case of Kontowitz. It involved the same statute that's at issue here. And in that particular case, we started looking at a test that involved the insurer and looking at whether or not the insurer had reasonable proof to take the position that they took. So the issue is not just whether things are fairly debatable, but you also have to consider the reasonable proof approach. How do you respond to that? Because obviously your opposing counsel says we had reasonable proof.
With reference to Kontowitz specifically, when they were looking at the issue of reasonable proof, that I believe was a factual issue regarding whether the injuries were actually caused by the accidents, or another example would be whether pre-existing conditions would limit coverage. Those are the type of factual issues where the courts are looking to see if there's reasonable proof or not reasonable proof with regard to the issue of fairly debatable. Here we did not have any factual determinations or proof, if you will, to offer with regard to coverage. We did have disputes, legal disputes only raised as a dispute to coverage.
And you think reasonable proof just involves issues of fact, not issues of interpretation?
With regard to fairly debatable in the Kontowitz case, when they were looking at reasonable proof, it was with regard to factual findings. Here, because we didn't have facts in dispute, as Justice Rogensack has pointed out, it's really was, if you want to call it a factual determination, as they did in the Good Humor case, it's a factual determination that the legal issues were not fairly debatable.
You're not relying, I see, on the Court of Appeals, which said, hey, here's your proof. The regulations required national states. That's paragraph 36, appendix 21. It said, regulations require national states pay the hospital's actual charges once Medicare Part A was exhausted. The Wisconsin OCI, the Office of Commissioner of Insurance, twice rejected national's interpretation of this policy. These are legal arguments and national states' interpretation. National states attempt to justify its position based on 2006 regulations adopted after the claim was made and even more years after the policy was sold doesn't create a fairly debatable question. So it seems to me the Court of Appeals was relying on the fact that the entities to which questions were addressed relating to the interpretation of the insurance policy. I mean, they may not have the power, they may not have the final word, but they were all saying hey, pay up, pay up. Is that reasonable proof? Or don't you think this is strong enough?
Oh, absolutely. If we look at reasonable proof from on the legal issues, those are exactly the sort of things that both the trial court and the Court of Appeals relied on. Here are the reasons why this was not a fairly debatable issue. Here's proof as to why it's not a fairly debatable issue.
The other thing is, you said, and I don't know how good this is, you said they could have paid you and then demanded it back. You know, a lot of times you pay some money to people, well, it's going to be gone by the time you finish litigating. But one assumes, maybe this is not an appropriate consideration, that the hospital will be there and will have this kind of money available.
Correct, and I think that such an approach...
Is that a good consideration? I mean, it's not mentioned here.
Correct. I think that the national states does have a choice whether to pay the full amount to avoid the running of the 12% interest and still pursue the litigation. If it's not, I see my time is up. May I continue?
You may finish. An ad, could they have put it into the court and gotten interest and then paid out?
That's exactly where I was going next. For example, an appeal does not stay the judgment below. Those sorts of negotiations between private parties as to whether we're going to pay to prevent post-judgment interest from running, or whether we're going to move for a stay, or whether we're going to risk giving up the funds, are made continually in the litigation process and could have been made in the context of this statute so that Frater would not have lost the time value of money over the last 8 years. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Farnham.
Thank you. Let me just briefly address the deference that this court owes to the determination of Mr. Zimmer in his two letters. I believe Justice Rogensack wrote that the construction of contracts is a question of law to which we give no deference to the decision of an administrative agency. I'm not even sure Mr. Zimmer's letters rise to the level of a decision. They're just letters. He said, pay up.
Did you have an opportunity to debate this with the Office of the Commissioner of Insurance? I mean, we had a case the other day, and one of the parties just wrote, the Department of Financial Institutions, and got a letter back that was favorable, but no one ever had a chance to debate it, argue it, so it was the next party kind of.
There were a series of letters back and forth. So the initial letter.
They're in the appendix.
That's correct.
Okay, go ahead.
They're in OCI's records, which are in the appendix. So the OCI says, you need to pay this claim. National State says, well, look at the model rules promulgated by the NAIC. We believe that that gives you a good indication of what the Medicare law requires. Zimmer said, well, that's not what the policy says. And no time doesn't say anything about the OCI's regulations, so we have no idea what he thought of those. National State's response to that was, look, the author of this NAIC letter is a head of an administration under OCI, and he's saying that post-Medicare exhaustion balance billing is not permitted. And he says that the insurance commissioners across the country speak with a unified voice. Do you mean to tell me that Wisconsin departs from that model? And there never was a response to that letter. So Zimmer doesn't really give us a lot substantive to go on in terms of a policy interpretation. He gives us nothing in terms of interpreting the regulation, and this court owes him no deference at all. As a matter of fact, when you look inside the OCI file, it's pretty clear from Diane Dombach's notes in that file that she didn't agree with Mr. Zimmer, or at least she didn't. That she, her notes clearly say that other administrative agencies in the federal government are saying that National States doesn't have to pay at this rate. So Mr. Zimmer's letters not only are due no deference, they're not the final word from OCI. As a matter of fact, in 2005, when OCI adopted the new regulation on this issue that we are currently under, they repeatedly said that they are clarifying what the state of the law is. And as a matter of fact, if you look at the
interesting things is that it has a section indicating what the cost for the private sector is going to be of the new rule. Now, keep in mind, if the new rule was that insurance company Medigap policies only have to cover up to the amount of the Medigap reimbursement rate under the new rule, but had to cover the whole thing under the old rule, that'd be a pretty big difference. Likewise, if in 2005, insureds now have to pick up everything that the Medigap policy wouldn't cover because it only covers at the reimbursement rate, that would be a substantial effect on insureds.
Counselor, I was very interested in that order as well, but it didn't give me as much comfort as I would have liked to have had, at least if I were arguing in your shoes, because the order says the proposed rule clarifies for Medicare supplement, but later in exactly the same sentence or same paragraph, it says the Medicare reimbursement rate, comma, a change which will limit insurers' financial exposure. So, you want to address that? I mean, it's in the same paragraph of
it
the
is. I interpret changes meaning a change in the wording. They changed the wording to specifically include the words limiting Medigap policies to the reimbursement rate.
Well, they say it limits an insurer's financial exposure on prolonged hospitalization.
Right. As I say, they don't list this as one of the major changes. This would be a very significant change. And OCI's kind of blasé approach to including these words suggests that they weren't making a change at all. They were clarifying it. It also suggests that they weren't making a change at all. They were clarifying it insofar as they're kind of paralleling what the National Association of Insurance Commissioners is doing when way back in 1997 they saw the same issue arising where hospitals were billing insureds and driving up the cost of the market for Medigap policies. And the NAIC was very concerned that the regulations were being misread. So when they enacted the new regulations that you discussed earlier, which are now approved by CMM or CMA, they also said that they were clarifying the rules. So I think on a federal level, on a state level, what we have is a clarification. It's also interesting that all of the language such as the may or may not be fully reimbursed under Medicare exists in today's regulation. So the extent that we read that language to say, no, the Medigap insurer is going to pay whatever the hospital charges, well, it clearly doesn't mean that today because it's in a statute or it's a correction in a regulation that says more explicitly than ever before that the Medigap policies are limited to the Medicare reimbursement rate.
Thank you, Counselor. Now, the insured is not before the court, as I understand it.
That's correct.
So nothing in this opinion, it would seem to me, that is going to be drafted should impose any costs on the insured. This is just between you and the hospital, right?
Well, except to the extent that the hospital is permitted to balance bill, but the policy doesn't cover it, in which case the liability would flow through to the insured, which is why, you know, our position is that the balance billing is not permitted at all, because if the insurance company weren't in the way here, then it would be a case. Frager did, after all, sue the insured. You know, their position is not that balance billing arises or is permissible only when there's a Medigap policy in a way. Their position is that balance billing after the exhaustion of Medicare reimbursement rates is at all times in Wisconsin permissible whether there's a Medigap policy or not.
So if you win on everything and Frager loses on everything vis-a-vis you, then the insured is still obligated on the outstanding bill?
Not if Frager is not permitted to balance bill.
Not if what?
Not if Frager is not permitted to balance bill. You're absolutely right. We can win on the policy, and we should. We can win on the regulations, and we should. But as we didn't really get to this today, but the Ninth Circuit and the Eleventh Circuit and other federal circuits have indicated, it's the bedrock principle of the Medicare system. Once the hospital gets in the system, it's getting guaranteed payments from the U.S. government for providing these services. It is a kind of an economy of scale situation where some patients it makes out on, some patients not so much. The difference here is that the Medicare benefits are exhausted and the rate goes up. Those
those courts went well out of their way to indicate that that just doesn't seem fair if a hospital's benefiting from the Medicare system. The reason those hospitals didn't have to, or correction, the reason those courts did not have to make a determination on whether Medicare was balanced, was permitted, or whether the hospital was permitted to balance bill the patient, is because in each of those cases, the hospital just sued the insured. So that's the difference. In this case, we actually, sued the insurer. In this case, we have the insurer and the insured. And so the ramifications of a determination that balance billing is permissible would be more dire for the insured.
Which Ninth Circuit case are you relying on, counsel?
I am relying on the Ninth Circuit case of Vencor versus National States Insurance Company.
But there, the judge made it quite clear that you'd have to be very careful in a case which is similar to this, that you do not impose liability on the insured, the patient, who is not before this court, and who may not have the same interest as the hospital, which is appearing before us.
Right, and that's why that court...
Judge Berzon's opinion, if I've got the right one.
And so that's why that court didn't have to go on to
right.
expressly rule that, and
that's
by
right.
the way, not only does the policy not cover this,
right.
But you couldn't balance bill even if the insured was here, since they're not
so
here.
So they just did not cover that.
Right.
So they avoided the issue I'm trying to bring forth.
It's a matter of judicial economy. The Ninth Circuit stopped, just like the Senate stopped. The Senate could have addressed balance billing. The sense of the policy and the regulations are clear. I don't need to address balance billing.
Great care has to be taken on that issue.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. I want to thank Attorneys Farnham and Lovren for an excellent job today in a complicated area involving state law, federal law, and an insurance policy. That concludes our hearing on 07-AP-934, Frederick Memorial Lutheran Hospital versus National States Insurance Company. The court will take a brief recess so the students may leave. New students, different students may enter. At about 11, there will be a siren through the building there testing the equipment. It is not a fire drill, and you will just have to protect your ears at the time. So the court's in recess. Other students will be brought in, and we're not going to show up until after that noise.